chapter 14. Now, Jesus, going from that real battle in the garden, now everything else is just going to happen. He is poised. He is in control. Even though he's being arrested, he's going to go through this mock trial. He's going to be put before the authorities of the Romans and eventually crucified. We'll look today at how he was betrayed, arrested, the trial before the religious authorities, and yes, even the sad picture of the denial of Peter as we finish this chapter in our session this morning. Let's take a look. Verse 43, where we left off. Immediately, while he was still speaking. See, he's the one that saw them coming. He comes back to his disciples. They're sleeping. He goes, it's enough. You know, rouse up. Let's go. They're coming. Let's go. And it's not like, let's go get out of here. Let's go meet them. And immediately while he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. And remember, Jesus predicted all of this. This is not a surprise. Three times in Mark, he told exactly how this was going to play out. And it does exactly how he predicted. This group comes from the chief priests, led by Judas, with lanterns marching through the streets of Jerusalem or across the Kidron Valley, now into this area of the garden where he was with his disciples privately, where Judas was aware, and now he has come. Now Judas, John tells us, received a detachment of troops, which is a particular word, which means there was about 600 men, soldiers, plus the temple guard, plus probably some of the observers of the chief priests and the Sanhedrin. So a multitude. They don't want to take any chances. They want to make sure that they stop this quickly. There's no riot. There's nothing that could stir everybody up and wake everybody up and cause a major riot. They want to squash it quickly, and they hope they'll do this. And so they've come from the Antonio Fortress through the streets of Jerusalem with soldiers with short swords and the temple guard with clubs. And Jesus, now first to see them, says, let's go. John records an interesting phenomenon. That the first encounter when they came wasn't Judas with the kiss, but was them hearing Jesus say authoritatively, who do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, I am. And they fell backward. Now, whether all 600 or 900 of them fell backward, you know, that it doesn't say in the scriptures, but at least those that would have been perhaps the religious leaders were taken back at his authority. And there was a stopping and a falling back to the ground. And of course, they get up and they ask again. And now Judas, of course, it says in verse 44 here, his betrayer had given them a signal saying, whomever I kiss, he's the one. Seize him and lead him away quickly. And as he had come, as soon as he had come, immediately he went up to him and said to him, Rabbi, Rabbi, teacher, teacher, and kissed him. And then they lay their hands on him and took him. So a prearranged sign that Judas has, because it's night, you know, perhaps even if there's no moonlight, it's hard to distinguish one from the other with their garb. And so he wants to make sure that the authorities get the right one. So that was the prearranged signal. I find it interesting, Judas. He's an interesting character. One who walked with Jesus for that many years and saw miracles, experienced that power. But he had not gone to the garden, because when they went to the garden, he went to the authorities. When Jesus was finishing up the message to his disciples there, even in the Passover meal, about the wonderful work of the power of the Spirit to come upon their lives, Judas was not there for that. The disciples had heard Jesus tell Judas, what you do, do quickly. And they assumed he had some purchase to make, and he went out, but he was arranging this with this sign. I will say this, one thing that you notice, it's kind of like, unless you really pay close attention, you notice that the descriptions of Judas by the authors of the Gospels show amazing restraint. Of all the things they could say about this guy, right? They basically say Judas, one of the 12. They don't go into too much detail about him. They don't rail on him. And you know, there's something wise about that. There's something that is aware. You're aware of your own weakness and your own soul's struggles. You're not about to rail on others. You know, I tell you what, those people who are very quick to talk about others are in very, very, indeed, they're very, very small themselves. And I think the greatness of heart of the gospel writers, even with Judas, the traitor, they're very careful not to malign him more than just express what happened and the facts that are here. But what was it about Judas? Greed, ambition, whatever it was that excited him about being a follower of Jesus in the beginning is pretty much all gone. And, you know, the only exit strategy he has is to make a few bucks out of it, apparently. Selling his soul for a few trinkets. Strange man. Was it resentment, maybe? Was he resentful the fact that Jesus did not have him as number one? He was under the inner circle, was Peter, James, and John, and Judas probably felt he should have been there. Maybe he was the ringleader of all the debate, who is the greatest, and wanted to put forth his resume, and he never seemed to break into that inner circle. But you know, he does represent quite a number of people who have had every opportunity to evaluate the person of Jesus, and yet have turned their heart, moved away from him. And now he betrays Jesus with a kiss. The word kiss is a word in the Greek for love, phileo. That was the sign. I will show him phileo, which in an outward demonstration would be a kiss, a friendship, an expression of friendship. When you meet someone, you would greet them with a kiss on the cheek. But in this case, when it says that he went up to him and kissed him, the word is not phileo. Well, it's an intensified form of that. It's kataphileo, which means he kissed fervently, affectionately, continually, prolonged. Now, it's probable that he prolonged the kiss for no other reason than just to make sure that the authorities had time to make sure that, okay, all right, yeah, yeah, he's kissing him, yeah, 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 he's making sure we know, yeah, okay, yeah, all right, we got it. And I just see Judas there, and of course Jesus says, betray me with a kiss, one of the other gospel accounts. You know, the most difficult challenge in life, I think, is to experience betrayal, to experience a Judas. Now that can happen in a marriage. Person betraying you from the vows they originally gave, now they're betraying by lust for another. Or in business. You know, you make arrangements in business, you have agreements, and greed leads some to betray their partners. Or in friendship, sometimes pride. You want to look better, so you find another group of friends that will lift you up, and you betray those other friends. In church, oftentimes ambition is a factor. People are ambitious. They perceive sometimes leadership in the church as being all about control, and they want that control. And of course, it has nothing to do with control and everything to do with influence. What makes betrayal so painful, however, it's the closeness of it. If a known enemy attacks you or slanders you, it's like people, yeah, they know they don't like you and it's not a big deal, and they just put that in that context. But if someone close to your inner circle turns on you, people that are onlookers look out and wonder, you know, they were in the inner circle. They knew what went on. They knew the inner workings. So there must be some truth to what they're saying and doing. That's what makes it so painful. And I think in some ways, every one of us, Jesus shows us how to do it. How do you handle this? You're going to encounter a Judas at some point in your life. It's a necessary part of our development as disciples. We're going to encounter a Judas. What makes this so powerful is Jesus and how he responds. He doesn't recoil from Judas. He doesn't push him away. Stop kissing me, you traitor. He lets him. In fact, even then, he's still trying to reach his soul by saying, betray me with a kiss, Judas. There's almost like still he's trying to penetrate into that hard heart. Help him to see what he's doing. You know, that betrayal is such a powerful thing. That actually this is prophetically foreseen in David's experience. King David had a very close counselor friend by the name of Ahithophel. And Ahithophel was his close companion. He was a guy that when you talked to him, it would be like getting counsel from God. He was so wise. Close friend with David. Until the day when Absalom fomented his rebellion, tried to take over and actually kill David. And Ahithophel was a part of it. And David was in shock. He could have understood if it was an enemy. In fact, in Psalm 55, he records verse 12, "For it is not an enemy who reproaches me, then I can bear it. Nor is it one who hates me, but one who has exalted himself against me. Then I could have hid from him." But notice he says, "It was you, a man, my equal, my companion, my acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together. We walked to the house of God in the multitude." That stung. Whether he was motivated by pride, greed, or revenge, betrayal is horrible. But Jesus shows us how to deal with it by a willing submissiveness. Because you see, when you just submit to the Lord in this, the Lord will fight your battles. He'll take care of it. And he'll deal with it. And certainly Judas has his end. Well, one of those who stood by, verse 47... Mark tells us, drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. Bad aim, apparently. Notice how he doesn't say who, and he doesn't say who the servant was. Do you ever wonder why some of the gospel accounts don't say and some do say? Matthew, Mark, and Luke were the early writers. It's believed that they didn't say who this was because Jewish authorities still around could have gotten their revenge, could have arrested them on this, you know, on the basis of the testimony. So it's perhaps they just kept it, you know, the name unknown or unspoken, but everybody knows who it was. John tells us later, yeah, it was Peter. Peter's the one that did that. Of course, there's a lot more to Peter. We're going to get to him because he will finish up with the thought of Peter, what he was doing. But we're also told the servant's name was Malchus in John chapter 18, verse 10. Malchus was a personal servant of Caiaphas, probably sent to observe. And here in the just observing, he's an easy target for Peter, and his ear gets cut off. Now, Mark doesn't go into the details, but Luke tells us that Jesus had to rebuke Peter, "Put away your sword, Peter. You take up the sword, you're going to perish by the sword." Great lesson in this regard. And then he also touches Malchus's ear and heals him. But Peter's misguided action could have brought the whole thing to a tragic end were it not for Jesus' quick action to heal him. Put away your sword. Great message for the church. Don't ever think you can win people to Jesus with coercion, force, pressure. Now, Islam conquers by the sword. That's in their Quran. I mean, it's very plain. If you go, you offer a peace to people, and if they receive it, great. They submit willingly, great. But if they don't submit, then you bring the sword, you destroy them, force them to submit. That is what Islam is about. And though there are moderate Islamic and very wonderful Muslim people, they are not following literally Islamic direction. There are those that change the whole jihad into just a struggle for the soul, and wonderful. I hope that they keep it that way, because otherwise they'd be a danger to society. But there are those that take it literally and think this is how it progresses. Well, that's how Muhammad grew his religion. He would come in, and that, I mean, they're just following his leaders. Well, Jesus had a different way. Put away your sword. Because, you know, you can win. In fact, just remember this about Jesus. If you remember one thing, the last miracle that he performs on the earth before he goes to the cross is he heals an enemy's wound. Remember that. This is what Jesus is about. This is when he says, "Love your enemies," he lives it. When he says, "Do good to those who despitefully treat you," he does it. And he models it for us. Listen, you want to see Christianity spread throughout the world? Let me tell you how it works. It works not by force, not by intimidation, not by pressure, not by cajole, but rather by that amazing, sweet influence of the love of God, the forgiveness of God, by your model, your example. Listen, Christians are the number one reason why people respond to the gospel. But they're also, remember what I've said, they're the number one reason why people reject the gospel, I believe, too, in many ways. Well, the real reason, of course, is the sin in the heart. But it's a good excuse. When a believer does not act as a believer. Because then, you see, there's not that open testimony. But when you're shining your light, when you're that salt of the earth, when you're living that forgiveness, this is what's powerful. This is why in some of the most radical Islamic nations like Iran, there are thousands of people coming to faith in Jesus. The believers in Christ there, though it's painful and difficult, and there's a death penalty for anyone who would convert someone to Christianity, they are on fire for the Lord. And you know, it's a great testimony for us. Because, you know, we have freedom in this nation. And yet we don't have that same fervent power. I believe there's something powerful about when people see that forgiveness. Like that case of that young man. Now, this was an Islamic radical, but it was actually an Orthodox Jewish sect that believes their whole calling in life is to kill Messianic believers, those who are Jewish who come to faith in Jesus, to try to intimidate them from responding to Jesus as Messiah. Because there are so many Jewish people now coming to faith, this movement has taken it upon themselves to train people, making bombs, trying to blow up and intimidate Christians. But the more they do, the more they try, the more Jewish people are coming to faith. This family, case in point, I met the father of the son who was, a bomb exploded in his face. It was a gift for Purim. And he opened it and it exploded. I mean, it blew the entire house out. It's a miracle he survived. It's a miracle that he could see, that he can hear. It is absolutely a miracle how this young man has been healed. But more than that, the powerful message, instead of it stopping that group of Messianic believers, the church has tripled and quadrupled in size. And the family who had this happen to them, they finally caught the guy and his wife that perpetrated this, and he's unrepentant. He said, "I'd do it again." I mean, it's just sick. But there are people like that. But instead of showing bitterness toward this family, they're actually raising funds to help support their children while they're away from their family, who are obviously in jail. But that's God. That's what God does in the heart of a believer. And Jesus models that for us with this healing. Now, Jesus answered, of course, in verse 48, and said to them, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me?" He's exposing their hypocrisy. "I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." See, Jesus never wastes anything here. He expresses this so that they would know this is fulfillment of scriptures. Isaiah 53 describes that he essentially, you know, when you follow that out, that he was taken from, or by oppression and judgment, he was taken away. This is exactly what the intent is. They are going to take him away to a mock trial. It's a facade of a trial. It's done at night. It's secretly. Everything about this is a sham. And he's basically saying it so that they would know, by the way, it's in the scriptures. It's right there. The picture is clear, though. Jesus laid his life down. He was not killed. The crowd wasn't needed, as Jesus wasn't abandoned or a robber. And verse 50, though, says, "And they all forsook him and fled." Their faith collapses. Listen, I don't believe it was because they were cowards. I don't believe that the disciples were just afraid, you know, "I got to get out of here," and they run for their lives. I think what really happened is quite obvious. They're kind of shocked that Jesus is just giving up. I mean, he's the Messiah. They're waiting for him to display his power and become the leader of the world, and he's giving up. And they're disoriented. They don't know what to do now. I believe that they're despairing now rather than they're cowards. I'm sure if Jesus had picked up a sword and started swinging, every one of them would have went down dying. I mean, they would have died. They would have fought to the death. But Jesus said, "Put your sword away." He willingly yields himself. "Here am I." And then in the other gospel tells us, you know, "You've got me. You don't need these. Let them go," so that the Bible would fulfill itself. He wouldn't lose one of them. Now, verse 51 and 52 is kind of an odd insertion here by Mark. "A certain young man followed him, having a linen cloth thrown around his naked body." It's kind of like a linen that one would sleep in. So it's kind of a nightgown in a way. "A young man laid hold of him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked." So you've got the first streaker. Well, I actually said it was the first streaker, but someone corrected me that Joseph was the first streaker in the Bible. Remember when Potiphar's wife grabbed him by, said, "Come lie with me," and he squirmed away and he ran out naked. First of all, it's just an odd thing here, right? But most commentators believe this was probably young John Mark himself, the author of this gospel, who traveled with Paul and Barnabas, who was Mary's son. They lived in a large house right there in the streets of Jerusalem. And it's probable that in the commotion, remember, He was still up and excited because the Passover meal was in that house most likely. And now, you know, he's in bed, but he hears this commotion. It wakes him up. And then he hears the commotion coming back the other way with Jesus. I believe that's probably when he jumped out. He's in his nightgown. He's looking out. He starts following along. And one of the young men nabs him. But he's young and strong and skates with his birthday suit and goes back home. But I think that he throws this in there so that you know he was an eyewitness to at least this part of it. Have you ever wondered, too, listen, how the gospel authors seem to know everything that happened even when they themselves weren't there and they write it down? Well, you remember that so many people who at first didn't believe, who were there when all these things happened, eventually became believers. Malchus would be one of them. It's probably why they know his name, because I believe he became a believer. So he could actually testify for himself what happened. And many of them, I'm sure the centurions around Jesus that were there when they were mocking and scourging him and saw, surely this is the Son of God, eventually became part of the church and were able to recount all the details. And they put all these details together and we have our gospel account. That is based on solid evidence. But what you're going to see now is a good example of how it's a lot harder to lie in harmony than you think. People who profess to think that the Bible was just made up and someone made these stories up, it's absolutely so crazy that it's like, look, Calvary Chapel movement has been around for 40 years or so. A little longer, actually. So in 40 years' time, I've been a part of it for about 30 plus years, and I've seen firsthand so many things in the Calvary Chapel movement. Now, if someone wanted to write a book right now about the Calvary Chapel movement and they began to make up all these wild stories that didn't even fit any of the facts, everybody that experienced it alive today would go, yeah, that's wrong. And you get everybody's testimony together, you'd have a pretty accurate record of what took place. Same thing with the gospel accounts. These things written in the first century, no one could have made all this stuff up without all these testimonies come out and say, that didn't happen. But this is a reliable record. And to show you how hard it is to lie in harmony, we're going to see a mock trial with false witnesses try to establish a case. Watch. They led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests and elders and the scribes. They first brought him to Annas, according to John. Annas didn't get what he wanted, sent him to Caiaphas, who was his son-in-law and the high priest that year. Annas was the power behind the scene, though. He and his four sons and his son-in-law basically owned the position of the high priest. They bought it with the best money that they had. And Caiaphas was a very powerful leader. 18 years he was there as high priest, which normally the term was four. And he controlled the temple, he profited from it, so he's very motivated to get Jesus out of the picture. So the very people that hate Jesus and want to get rid of him are going to be his judges. That should tell you right away, you're not going to get a fair trial. Imagine if you were alleged to have stolen the judge's car, and you had to go before the very judge whose car you allegedly stole. Would you get a fair trial? He would recuse himself. It would be an unjust, unfair trial. He'd have to have somebody else try that. Oh, and this is the case. So this is just a breach of justice. There's no justice allowed here, because notice what happens. Peter follows at a distance. They right into the courtyard of the high priest. Hold on to Peter. We're going to come back at him as he sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but notice, found none. Now they're eagerly motivated to find something on him. They tried in public and failed. Now they're trying to buy witnesses, and they still can't get any collaboration. It's a lot harder than you think. Notice what it says here. For many, verse 56, bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. Then some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, well, we heard him say, I'll destroy this temple, and in 3 days, I'll raise it up again. I'll build another made without hands. So they're trying to get these witnesses in, but even so, verse 59 says, not even then did their testimony agree. By the way, this is not far off today. This is very contemporary. there are those highly motivated to make Christianity look like it's a fraud. A lot of powerful people behind this to try to discredit Christianity, because in a sense, this foundation of belief in God is holding back what people call the New World Order, the New Age, or whatever you want to call it. But this idea that man is exalted himself and whatever man wants, put man at the center. There's a lot of money and power behind it. And of course, you shouldn't be surprised when there is a concerted effort to discredit, defame, mock Christianity. But the funny thing is, it's not the first time in history. During the time of the Renaissance, before that, under the various periods of time, there have always been major attacks. And yet, eventually, you see the testimony comes out, clear as a bell. And the hearts of those who are changed are winsome, and there's power. Well, so they're doing everything they can. They've got the best witnesses money could buy, and they still can't get them in harmony. Why? Because, listen, it's a lot easier to get to the truth in a court case than you think. Because you cannot get testimony to lie in harmony very easily. That always breaks down. Lies are very difficult to be consistent. But when the truth is, like the little boy I remember going to court, he was a witness in a situation, and the prosecutor tried to grill him and said, "Tell me, young man, did your father tell you how to testify?" And the little boy goes, "Yes, he did." "Aha! I knew it! Tell me, what did your father tell you to say?" The little boy says, "My father told me to tell the truth no matter what. And so that's what I'm going to do." So listen, you can't stop that. That's testimony. Now here's the interesting thing. There's four girls that got caught coming home late after curfew into the dormitory in college. The overseer of the dormitory was right there to catch them red-handed. And one of the girls very quickly, cleverly said, "Well, we had a flat tire." And so the overseer said, "Okay, no problem. Go to bed." So they thought they were home free. Till the next morning, she called the four girls in, put them in separate rooms at a desk with a piece of paper, and asked the question, "Which tire? And where were you when it happened?" You know how hard it would be to lie in harmony? See, that's why, don't let anybody try to trick you with these witty little things like, "Well, we really don't know if we actually have a record of what really happened. So many people and years have passed, and we don't really know." And they wrote it like 20, 30 years after it happened. Remember, 40 years from Calvary Chapel, and there's really been no real book written on it, just a few little things. When someone finally writes a book on the movement, we're all around. Last 40 years, we'll know. You can't lie in harmony. People are there to basically say, no, that didn't happen. No, I was there. This testimony can't agree. And so finally, by the way, that's what I'm saying. You should have confidence. You've got God's word. This is a historical record of what happened. Well, the high priest, he's getting frustrated. He stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" But he kept silent and answered nothing. This is frustrating because, you see, if Jesus opens his mouth, he's actually giving credence to some of this testimony, and it's all a sham. He's not even bothering. So the high priest is frustrated because nothing's coming together. He's afraid his case is falling apart. He's embarrassing himself. And so finally, the high priest asked him. Now, Matthew tells us he put Jesus under oath. He says, "I adjure you, I command you under oath to speak." And he says, "Are you the Christ," or the Messiah? Christos in Greek, Mashiach in Hebrew. "The Son of the Blessed," or the Son of the Blessed One, or God. The only time this word is used, it's speaking of God. "Are you the Messiah, the Son of God?" is what he's asking him. So he's frustrated and he wants him to speak, and he gets what he wants. In fact, to his delight, Jesus responds in verse 62 and says, "I am." Now, why did Caiaphas want him to say that? Because they did not believe this, and they thought if they could get him to testify that, then pretty much they could accuse him of blasphemy, of dishonoring God. Jesus said, "I am." He is the faithful witness. He must speak the truth. But then he also warns. Notice what he warns him. It's a sobering warning if you're Caiaphas. "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power," that is of God, and coming with the clouds of heaven. Under oath, Jesus replies, I am. And he claims the Son of Man, which is a messianic title, and he claims coming with the clouds of heaven, which is Daniel. I mean, you could quote Daniel and Psalm 110 and Revelation and all of these passages to show this is none other than claiming to be God, equal with God. Well, the priest then, verse 63, confirms that what Jesus is claiming. See, some people believe that Jesus never claimed to be God, that was made up later. The testimony tells us right here, which is why he was crucified. The high priest tore his clothes and said, what further need do we have of witnesses? He tears his clothes, which was illegal according to Leviticus 10. And then, of course, the Talmud made some exceptions for blasphemy. And he says in verse 64, you've heard the blasphemy. That is, a man claiming to be God. Because they didn't believe he was the Son of God. Now, was Jesus blaspheming? Of course not. He was the Son of God. He made that claim because it was true. They didn't acknowledge it. They claim it's blasphemy, and they say, what do you think? And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. And some spit on him, to blindfold him, to beat him, to say to him, prophesy. There's an interesting twist on that, because you see, as they blindfold him and beat him, and then they ask him to prophesy and tell us who hit you. The gospel, other gospel account writes. You see, in Isaiah 11, the Messiah, it is said, would judge not with the sight of the eyes or decide by the hearing of his ears, but with righteous judgment. So they had this tradition among the rabbis, according to the Talmud, it misinterprets this, that the Messiah could judge by smell. And so what they're saying by doing this is they're mocking him. They're putting a blindfold on, saying, if you're the Messiah, now you should know who it is. And if you can't tell who it is, then you're not the Messiah. And so they're beating him, and they're striking him, and they're spitting on him. But unfortunately for them, this isn't going to give them the right to kill him. That's going to happen the next chapter, because now they take this religious trial, they have to turn it into a civil trial. Only one problem is blasphemy, the charge, is not going to fly with the Romans. They could care less. So they turn it into a trumped-up treason charge. He says he's the king. And that's how they sell it to Pilate. But let's come back to Peter now. I find it interesting. Mark always does things in sandwich form. He has the trial with the religious authorities, and then that's sandwiched in between Peter's failure and then the other trial. Peter's prominent here in this regard. But, well, what's going on here with Peter? Verse 66, it says, as now Peter was below in the courtyard. Now picture this scenario. They've actually discovered in Jerusalem what they believe, pretty certain, is Caiaphas' house. They've uncovered it. They found inscriptions to Caiaphas in it. Of course, there's the Armenian church in the Armenian quarter who have what they call as Caiaphas' house. So they've got a few Caiaphas' houses there. But the idea is both of them have the same kind of a layout. In that day, the homes, if you look at the real nice homes, you know, today there's a certain layout that's popular. Well, this layout was basically, if you looked at it from the outside, it'd be like a wall with a gate. And that's it, a wall with a gate. They didn't care about the outside. But when you went in the gate, you come into this beautiful courtyard, all landscaped out nice with marble. You'd have a couple of stories. You'd have the upper story with the balcony. You know, all the rooms up there, then all the rooms down here, and a courtyard in the middle. That was a very common home among the wealthy. Caiaphas had such home, but how did Peter get in there? John tells us that John had some connections. He got in because he was related to the high priest's family. And he spoke up for Peter to get him in. Now, he did that as a friend, but unfortunately that was not going to work out very well for Peter, because Peter shouldn't have even been there. And you know, listen, there's a lesson here. When you're where you're not supposed to be, you're going to do what you shouldn't do. And this is what happens. One of the servant girls of the high priest came, and when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, you also were with Jesus of Nazareth. Remember, anytime someone says Jesus of Nazareth, it's almost with a disdain. It's like you're Jesus, that hick from that small town up north in Galilee. But he denied it, saying, I neither know nor understand what you're saying. And he went out on the porch, and a rooster crowed. Jesus said, before the rooster crows twice, you'll have denied me three times. Well, then a servant girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by, this is one of them. Now, here he is warming himself by the fire. Now, that was a dumb move. If you're trying to be incognito, you're right up in the fire. It's glowing in your face. Hello, Peter. So now he's forced to deny it twice. And then, verse 70, it says, he denied it again. And then later, those who stood by said to Peter again, surely you are one of them, for you're a Galilean, and your speech shows it. Peter, shut up. You've got a thick Galilean accent. I mean, come on. If you were living down in the deep south, out in the swamp somewhere, you came to the big city, you don't really have to tell people where you're from. It's pretty obvious, just by your accent. When I came out to California, I had this Midwestern accent. I still can't get rid of that one word, water. I say water. And everyone goes, whoa, Midwest. Yeah, I can't hide it. So, you know, and I was listening to some words Chad was singing, Hosanna, the way he said it. It sounds like Michigan. I don't know where he's from, but you can tell sometimes just by certain words. Well, he can't hide where he's from. So, sadly now, verse 71, this is a tragic picture. He began to curse and swear, I swear to God, I'm not. Can you imagine? I swear in the Bible. I don't know this man of whom you speak. The second time the rooster crowed, and Peter called to mind the word that Jesus had said to him, before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times. And when he thought about it, he wept. What a bitter picture. Peter cracking under the pressure. But oh, how necessary for Peter. See, one of the things that I think one of the greatest discipleship lessons for all of us is seen right here in this experience is Jesus models for us what it is to suffer, to go willingly, to submit perfectly unto the Lord and depend upon the Lord and His power. And as a man, remember, Jesus did that. Jesus doesn't go through this flushed with all this supernatural power like He's floating, He doesn't experience any of these things. He goes to the cross as a man. And Peter, you see, he's just heard this whole big sermon about the Holy Spirit and the need for power and all of these things. The Holy Spirit will empower you, will guide you and lead you. But he's not there. The Lord said to him, look, you're all scattered. You're going to deny me three times, Peter. But Peter is still flush with his human energy. I can do it. I can do it. Listen, this is what happens oftentimes when people are following Jesus from afar. They see Christians and they try to mimic that. But you cannot mimic Christianity. It's something you've got to experience personally deep down. And when you do, you're not going to be apt to trust in yourself. One of the great evidences of a true born-again experience is there is not self-confidence anymore. It is you're aware of your own weakness, and so you come to the Lord. Paul the Apostle writes, when the Lord says to him, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is perfected in weakness. So Paul says, I take pleasure then in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses. For when I am weak, then I am strong. There's a great lesson there. When you're strong, you're going to end up weak. Here's Peter with his love for Jesus and his passion and his zeal, and I can do it. What does he end up doing in his own strength? Out of fear for his life, confusion of Jesus being arrested. He's outside there in the enemy's fire, warming there himself in the courtyard. He shouldn't have even been in. And they recognize him, and now he's got to cover himself to the point of even giving an oath, swearing by whatever he swore by that he's not one of those disciples. And then the rooster crows, and wow. One of the other gospel accounts says that when the rooster crowed, Jesus, presumably in one of the rooms there being held, looked out and saw him there, and he saw the eyes of Jesus, and it probably just melted him. You know, when the Lord has the strength, and I'm aware I have none, we make a great team. But if I think I've still got it, if I think I can still do it, Jesus says, okay, let me handle this one. I got it. Then I'm not going to have his strength. Our team area is not there. The team membership in the Lord is, he's got all the strength, we have none. All right, perfect. Well, before you can be filled, you got to be recognize you're empty. Hudson Taylor, I love how he put it. He said, God chose me because I was weak enough. You got to like that. See, sometimes we sit here and we think, you know, I've got skills, I've got abilities, and God, you're probably blessed. You've got the right man here for the job. No, actually, he's not. Because there's too much of us. Too much self is in there, reeking of self. When my strength is done, it's a great lesson. And I think that's the key for Peter. But it was a bitter lesson for him to learn. But you know, he learns it. Read Peter's epistles, 1st and 2nd Peter, and you will discover a totally, dynamically different guy. No self-confidence there. Humble, but authoritative in the Lord. And I love one passage he says in 1 Peter 4:11. He says, whoever serves, let him serve with the strength God provides. Did he get it or what? Did he learn that by experience? You better believe it. We need that too. Jesus shows us how to essentially influence the world, which is what he does through his disciples, and they will through the world, and the gospel will go through the whole world. It's by a sense of weakness, in a sense, yieldedness to the Lord, so the Lord can show his power. I love what my wife says about submission, you know, because, you know, she'll teach the women, and the women are called to submit to their husbands as unto the Lord. People in the world hear that, and at the back of their hair stand up in the back of their neck. They get that really weird feeling, submit. And I love my wife's definition. I don't know where she got this from, but a great definition for submission. She says, duck and let the Lord hit him. You know, so many women trying to lead their family and take charge because their husbands aren't leading, and they're trying to control. And, you know, listen, the Lord's called you ladies to submit unto your husbands and let him be that leader. It's a great definition. Just duck and let God get him. As long as you try to take control, then the Lord can't get to him. So let the Lord deal with it. Jesus shows us this. I mean, he's the one that models submission for us. And we're to submit to one another in the fear of Christ. You see, this is true biblical relationship. When you have skirmishes in a church and there's politics and there's this, you know, this person, that fighting, it's this person and all that stuff and the divisions, that's all because nobody really wants to follow Jesus' example. And you know, that's how to do it. Submitting to one another in the fear of Christ. And Jesus models it for us as he lays his life down. Peter still got to learn. But he's going to learn.